This is Sarah Koenig, host of Serial. We have a new show. It's called The Preventionist. It's about something strange that happened in eastern Pennsylvania. Parents claiming they'd walked into a hospital to get medical care for their children and then were forced to leave without them. Why were these parents suddenly losing custody of their kids? From Serial Productions and The New York Times, it's The Preventionist. Eligible Time subscribers can listen right now on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, so head there to subscribe, or listen anywhere October 30th.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, those dreaming eyes of mine of music, news, and criticism. I'm John Caramonico. It's not that important, but I'm on vacation this week. Not really on vacation, I'm just in my house. And D'Angelo passed away this week. And that is a person who it is worth coming off vacation to talk about. D'Angelo died at 51 earlier this week. I'm certain that you're familiar with his oeuvre. At the beginning of the show, you're listening to Brown Sugar. This is the title track of D'Angelo's first album from 1995. D'Angelo released three albums in his lifetime. He released Brown Sugar. He released Voodoo in 2000, Black Messiah in 2014. Three singular albums that are, to my mind, all masterpieces, but that function in different ways, even if the sort of underlying gifts are the same. D'Angelo arrived at a moment in the mid-90s when hip-hop, and by extension R&B, because R&B was really in concert with hip-hop by the time his first album came out, were at an intense period of glamour and glitz and shininess. And it's hard to overstate how striking it was to hear Brown Sugar and to understand that he was a person who had absorbed all the same music, all the same reference points, was living the same life, and had come to a completely different proposition. A few years later, when Voodoo arrived, that is the product of intense labor and study from D'Angelo, as much a historian and preservationist as a musician, made in concert with Questlove and is sort of in proximity and in collaboration with the collective that would come to be known as the Soulquarians. D'Angelo had a huge success on that album with a song called Untitled. You certainly know the video in which D'Angelo is singing largely unclothed. And that song became so successful and so defined his public image that it began to destabilize his work and became a burden. He had a rough few years in the 2000s. There were struggles with substances, some legal issues. Eventually, he comes back and gets back to work in the later 2000s. And when Black Messiah came out in 2014, it felt like it was in direct conversation with what was happening out in the world, in American public life, in the harshest parts of American public life. I was lucky enough to see D'Angelo perform a couple times, three times maybe. I also was lucky enough back in 2000 to spend about an hour and a half interviewing D'Angelo and Beck side by side for the cover of the Fader magazine. This is the Fader issue 3. You can find it online if you Google it. You know, as a journalist, you don't want to pretend to have an unusual purview into someone's life simply because you sat in a room with them for some period of time, be it an hour or a day or a week. But you do pick things up. You do see things. When people ask me about that cover, because it is a cover and a story that a lot of people ask about because of the sheer improbability of it. Why are these two people sitting in a room together? And why are they talking to each other? And I think that was part of the Fader's provocation at the time, which was prescient, to be honest. But I also think, candidly, both of those people sitting in that room were also a little bit thinking, like, what exactly are we doing here with each other? And I always say that I think Beck was extremely excited to talk to D'Angelo. And D'Angelo, I don't want to say he was unexcited to talk to Beck. I do have moments where I wonder exactly if he knew all of what Beck was. There's a part in the interview where he talks about seeing Beck perform on an award show and maybe receive an award. You don't get the sense that D'Angelo was super dialed in on the full catalog that Beck had. That's fine, but I think it actually speaks less to D'Angelo not caring about that, but more to say that D'Angelo had spent the bulk of the time in the prior 3 or 4 years absorbing a very different kind of music history and then trying very hard to put out an album, which was Voodoo, that would establish his place in that history, even if he didn't necessarily have legacy on his mind. I think he just sensed that there had been a vibration ongoing for decades, and he felt like he belonged in it. And him and Questlove and everybody else worked hard to create something that fit seamlessly as an extension of that. So no shots to Beck. Anyway, go read that interview. And also some other interviews done by the folks who we're going to be talking to today. First, we're going to talk to Touré. Touré, a longtime music journalist, all the way back to the early to mid-90s. Touré spent time with D'Angelo in the late 90s in advance of the release of Voodoo at Electric Lady with Questlove, observing as they did their homework. So Touré is going to come and talk about those first 5 years, especially from Brown Sugar all the way up through Voodoo. And then Joseph Patel is going to come. And Joseph actually also has interviewed D'Angelo twice. Once back in the Voodoo era for Paper Magazine for a cover that's also very indelible from that era. And then not long ago, maybe a year and a half ago, for the documentary Sly Lives, which Joseph produced, directed by Questlove, in which Questlove and D'Angelo talk about Sly Stone and the burdens that Sly Stone faced along his path. But it's pretty clear that he's talking about much more than Sly Stone. So we're going to talk to Joseph about that, and also how D'Angelo both changed and also did not change across all those years. So let's just get into it right now. Touré is here. Look, if you've been following journalism for the last 30 years, which is a lot of years, you have read Touré all the way back in Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, Vibe, and more. Right now, he's on YouTube at Rap Latte. He's on TikTok at Touré Show. He's leaning in. He's telling stories. He's here to talk about his time back in the late 90s in the orbit of the Soulquarians, D, Questlove, Erica, et cetera, et cetera. Touré, welcome back to Popcast, not your first rodeo.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, before we get into like the particulars of what you were covering back then, I wonder if you can just map out your essential D'Angelo. Is it a song? Is it a live recording? Is it a memory of a show you were at? Like, is there one thing that really stuck in the front of your mind when you heard the news and have been processing over the last few days?
You know, D'Angelo has been a central figure in my sort of musical cosmology. I mean, 2 months ago, I made a video for YouTube about the whole neo-soul era and revolution, and D'Angelo was the leader of that. And so he was the thumbnail, and he was the first big sort of movement in that conversation. I mean, he really launches into the neo-soul conversation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, I've always been sort of thinking about him. I mean, like, Untitled is just such an unimpeachable, timeless, sort of just epic thing. It's just this towering thing of like, if you can make that, I don't need to hear anything else to understand, oh, we're dealing with a serious genius here. And part of what Untitled gets at, because like, think about Adore and International Lover and some of the great epic Prince love Prince sex songs. And like, D'Angelo and Questlove told me they made that album as a, you know, an audition tape for Prince to say, maybe he'll hear this.
A great detail in your story.
Maybe he'll hear this and say, oh my God, I want to work with those guys on an album. Now, I mentioned that on TikTok and a bunch of people were like, Prince is so stupid for not taking them. Prince did not use any producers, right? No, there was nobody else in the studio when he's making music. So it's not like he worked with Timbaland and he should have worked with the, like, he's like, that's nice, guys. I don't work with other people. I don't need anyone else. I play everything I make. But their impetus, their inspiration was, can we make something that would impress this guy we love? And like, we were talking about this the other day on Rap Latte, like if you are trying to make art to impress your idols, that might push you to a higher level, right? I think as creators, we think about the average audience member and how it will hit them. But like, think about like, what would I do as a musician or a writer or filmmaker or whatever that would impress my OG, my idols, you know, like would make them go, oh, like, and so that was the vibe. And like Prince probably surely before Purple Rain we're talking about, like Dirty Mind, 1999 controversy, like that era of Prince, I think they were really thinking about for that project, that moment. But that is such an incredible sort of thing hanging over this. Like we wanted Prince to think we were doing the right thing.
And it's interesting because like when I reread your story this week, I saw that line. It's obviously such a special thing. And they were so young. It's like we think of Questlove as an elder now. Obviously, D'Angelo's been in our lives for 2+ decades. It's interesting to see them in that moment and really understand that it wasn't always the case. They were aspirants at a certain time in their career. And when I saw that sentence, there was that quote from them functioned on two levels, I thought. On the one hand, I think they were literally probably saying, we really hope, we would love to work with Prince. Like, we, like, that's actually what we're saying. But the other thing is what you were just alluding to, which is we want this person to know what he meant to us. And we want him to know that we are explicitly trying to be in conversation with him. And also we understand ourselves being in conversation. Like, we know we're good enough. It's not just like a random person who's just like, I love Prince and I made a song and I threw it out. It's like, we know. We're in the lineage, and that confidence, that's both like I'm a supplicant, but it's also like, yeah, I know I got here. I know what we're doing.
I mean, another part of that whole conversation, what they were doing, they were at war. They felt like there's a lot of commercialism, bullshit going on in R&B. We want to return it to something more intimate, something more raw, something more real. This is not about hooks and choruses. This is not about samples. And there's nothing wrong with samples. But this is about real music, instrumentation, real inspiration. These songs come out of jam sessions and they feel like that. And you can't really like, they're not like any artist could just take it and like do it. Like these are D'Angelo expressing himself moments. And like, you can't cover Untitled. You can't cover Africa. Like, these songs are deeply meant for and from D'Angelo. I just was remembering his father was a Pentecostalist preacher, and his grandfather on his other side, his mom's father, was also a Pentecostalist preacher. So, like, he had the church coming at him from both sides. And you can definitely hear the church and the rural church in his music. Guy's playing organ in his father's church before he's tall enough to reach the pedals.
Can you talk about, like, and we'll get to the sort of like philosophical tension of Untitled and that moment, like we'll walk towards that. But I wonder, in the present day looking backwards, we know there's actually not loads of D'Angelo interviews. He went reclusive for a long time. He had struggles. He had legal struggles. He had substance struggles. In the moments from Brown Sugar up through when you were able to spend time with those guys around the Voodoo sessions and into Voodoo.
Well, I interviewed him on Brown Sugar as well.
You interviewed him on Brown Sugar too.
For the New York Times, actually. That was a New York Times
pull it.
Story.
We're going to pull it. We're going to pull it. We're going to pull the quote. How visible was he? Like, did you get flickers of that public reluctance even during what we now know were kind of like his most prime public years?
Look, you know, he's a brilliant person, but I think brilliance manifests or expresses itself in different ways. You know, in front of a keyboard, on a stage, this is one of the most genius people in the world. Mm-hmm. Sitting and talking to you was not necessarily his strongest area. Not that he couldn't have a conversation, but I think I got a lot more out of being around him and watching how he does his thing and how he moves through the world than sitting and talking to him. And he said some really interesting and valuable things about his music and his childhood, but there's definitely many people who I felt like were much better at expressing themselves in an interview context than he was. But then you go to the keyboard and he's leaps and bounds ahead of everybody else.
Saying everything he needs to say. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Brown Sugar era. You were alluding to the sort of creeping commercialism in R&B and obviously in hip hop during that era. We had, and this is a spoiler to some people, but not everybody, our next episode is with Erykah Badu, who was on our couch recently before D'Angelo passed. And she talked a lot about understanding her first album in opposition almost to everything that had been happening in that moment. And one thing we talked a lot about, Baduism, but I also think holds for D'Angelo's first album is you really feel the hands on it. You know, you really feel the playing. You feel the tactile quality. And that felt so, you could hear the hip hop in it, so you could play it back to back and understand the commonalities between the two threads. But the tactileness of those albums is, I think, maybe it's the loudest part of their calling card, even if it is fundamentally a quiet act. And I wonder if you could talk about how Brown Sugar landed and how did it feel to listen to that in the midst of the Bad Boy, in the midst of the Death Row, like in the midst of everything that was happening on the Hot 97s of the world. Mm-hmm. What did it mean to hear instruments played like that in that context?
Yeah, I mean, Brown Sugar, the song, was one of the songs of the summer that year. Mm-hmm. I believe that was 95. Mm-hmm. It was just this beautiful piece of music that signaled, oh, there is a real serious musician over there. I think some of us in the critical space were like, there's a lot of promise there. It's not fully realized with Brown Sugar. People were like, these are really sketches of songs. They're not really, really songs. And like, there's tremendous promise, but it needs to be like reined in. And we have no doubt this guy's going to get there. But like, imagine, you know, a rookie gets to the league and he's a little raw. He's a little out of step, but you could see he's incredibly talented and he will figure it out and get there. And obviously they did. There's definitely a line as a hip hop person, and that is like my personal culture. I have felt generally just a little distanced from traditional R&B, like that's over there. And sometimes I like that. But for the most part, I'm like, all this singing about like love and sex, like, you know, what are you doing in the street? Do you have a gun? Like, can you rap?
When you say traditional R&B, are you thinking 70s and 80s stuff? Or are you thinking even the stuff that was still happening in the 90s, but felt increasingly adult contemporary in a way?
I'm talking about the AC 90s, right? I mean, even in the 80s, I wasn't really into R&B. 70s soul music and funk music is everything and is the basis of hip-hop, right? So not to bet that. But when neo-soul came, first D'Angelo, Erica, Lauren, Jill, some others, there was no separation. All of us who lived for hip-hop, we're like, well, all of that counts as well. Like, that's hip hop adjacent. Yep. Like, they're down with us, even though they're not singing. Like, there was no like, oh, this is R&B. Like, this is our stuff as well. I think there's an Afrocentrism in the vibe, in the music, that is like, that is doing what we also go to hip hop for ideologically, spiritually. Mm-hmm. Whereas just getting in a studio and singing about how much you love her or how much you want to lay her down is not doing anything for me, right? Mm-hmm. You know, talking about you want her thong, like, you know, that's not doing anything for me. But like, I'll see you next lifetime. Mm-hmm. Oh, or, you know, Brown Sugar is about marijuana. Every song in the 90s in hip hop had to make reference to marijuana. It was like a law. Yep. And it's like, oh, look at this guy.
with the cornrows.
Yeah, he's doing
making a song about marijuana. Like, get the fuck out of here.
But no, I mean, you know, the love of D'Angelo and Neo Soul was there right away. And it was, there was no separation for those of us who loved hip hop. Obviously, those are our brothers and sisters, and we're rocking with them. And
dare I say, I felt like the R&B of that era that you're referring to almost looked down upon hip hop. That there was like, there was skepticism coming from that generation, from that world. And one of the things that I think marks D and Erica specifically in that time, when you hear the production, production, it's live band, but when you hear the drum patterns, you hear the same things or very, very kin things that you would hear in rap records just played organically. And so in a way, I sort of almost viewed it as an extension of like, even like Guru, what Guru was doing with Jazzmatazz and things like that, of kind of like, yes, like we have a hip hop framework, but I want to show you how I can incorporate some of these other tools that people have been using for decades, but actually put them towards our end.
I personally hated Jazzmatazz.
I guess. Yeah. I don't love it either. Candidly. Like, it's not my favorite.
Against it. I saw and see D'Angelo and Lauren and Erica as a continuation of what we fell in love with this in the 70s with Curtis and Sly and Marvin and Nina and these sort of people. And I think that D'Angelo, if that's a town, he lives near where Curtis and Sly live. Marvin Gaye is in the town, but he's on the other side of town. And like D'Angelo lives near Curtis and Sly. And I don't mean level. I mean like the vibe and the quality of what they're bringing to you. And Jimi Hendrix is over there somewhere. But I mean, these influences were very purposeful. Voodoo took 5 years because they would spend hours just listening to Jimi Hendrix or Sly Stone or Al Green or whatever, Curtis Mayfield, for a couple hours. We're just listening. Right. And then we're going to play, you know, Al Green's album or Jimi Hendrix's album. And then out of that, we jam into, oh, this groove feels good. Let's keep going with it. Oh, that becomes Africa or Devil's Pie or whatever. Fuck the slice, want the pie. Why is why? Till we fry. Watch us all stand in line. Most slice of the devil's pie. Drugs and thugs. That's sort of like the structure of how they're making things.
Very luxurious. Sounds luxurious in the modern context, especially. Oh, extremely luxurious.
You can't spend 5 years making an album now. And like a lot of the time was not actually working on the album. It was just listening to music, which is a brilliant way of doing it. But, you know, this is part of the downfall. I talk about this in my Neo Soul essay, that this is part of the downfall of Neo Soul, that the people making it were such perfectionists and so brilliant that they took many years in between albums. So this is part of the problem and part of why Neo Soul in its first iteration sort of goes away. D'Angelo, Lauren, these people don't reappear for many, many years. And like the whole thing's just sort of like shrinks.
We're getting into the era. You wrote this Rolling Stone profile. You're in the studio, Questlove and D. I wonder if you can talk about their relationships specifically. Like, what was D'Angelo looking for from Questlove? And what did Questlove seek to express through what he was able to do with D'Angelo that he was not able to do with others?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, D'Angelo's maybe the greatest talent of his generation. Yeah. And, you know, Quest is a genius. So there's a lot that they can play off of each other and communicate. I mean, they had this love of the old school that was just unparalleled. So, I mean, you know, I think about D'Angelo and Quest as well as like, they are incredibly talented and also the hardest workers. So, you know, the whole Michael Jordan thing, like, you know, the best students. So they talked about Yodas, which were all those 70s giants that we've named, and Fela Kuti and Jimi Hendrix and this, all that whole 70s canon, and James Brown as well, obviously. And the things about the Yodas, the videos, the albums, the books were called treats. And the whole thing was to consume as many treats from the Yodas as you could. And they would soak these things in together. And Quest already had an encyclopedic knowledge of all this stuff. And Dee has spent a lot of time listening to this stuff too, but then they kept just grabbing more and more and more and more. I think there's just an incredibly deep love of music from both of them. And so like an expression of music and like finding a groove, finding a space to be like, this is something like real and organic that we can talk about musically and express. But they, I mean, they loved each other. They were total bros together. I mean, Quest is such like a little bro, but I almost feel like a lot of times Dee was sort of looking at Quest like, what should we do next? What should we do next? And Quest would, you know. So I was at the, were you at the Tramps show with D'Angelo Prince?
No, I know the one, but no, unfortunately I wasn't.
Claire Danes was there. Sean Lennon was there. Being like, it's like 200 people at Tramps 1 a.m. Yeah. Prince, D'Angelo, and Quest, right? Quest on the drums.
It's like an after show, right? It's like an after show for another Prince thing. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Starts about 1 a.m., 2 a.m., something like that. They jammed on, I believe it was Brown Sugar for a while. And they jammed on something else for a while. And then this is the period when Prince was not doing his old, I believe this was the cymbal period. And so you couldn't say, there was no pronounceable word for his name. And he was not doing any of the old sort of sexual songs from his past. And, you know, Quest is like, you know, always the impish one who's like, let's see if we can push this too far and see what happens. And, you know, Dee was just there along for the ride, enjoying the moment. And Quest called for them to go into Head. And I don't remember seeing Prince leave. In my memory, he just disappears. Just like a poof. And he's no longer there.
Yeah, he vaporized. Yeah.
And it was like, is he coming back? He's just getting something. He's coming back. He's not leaving, right? And, you know, that could have been an hour or 2 hour show, but Quest had to push it. And Prince was like, fuck that. He probably ran backstage and ran to the limo and maybe they did another show or maybe they just went to the hotel. So, you know, that was like Quest being, you know, like the kid in school who's like, let's see what happens if we throw a paper airplane at the teacher when her back is to the, you know. And Dee was like, you know, okay. Like he wasn't driving. Quest was driving at that moment. And I think a lot of the relationship was kind of like that. But I mean, you know, we obviously understood. He obviously understood like D'Angelo is this once in a generation leader. You know, Quest is a genius musical director. There will never be the Quest Love solo album with him out front. You know, he's not like Peter Gabriel was a drummer, right? Not Peter Gabriel. Phil Collins was a drummer.
Phil Collins.
Right. Right. Who becomes a leader. Right. Quest isn't going to do that. And he's got all the personality in the world. He could advertise every product and he's done a million ads because he's so cool and charismatic and lovable. But he's not going to be a leader. D'Angelo was basically born to be a leader. And they all knew from age three, he's going to be a musician. He's going to be a leader. You want him at the front of the stage, dancing, doing his thing, licking the lips, singing to the girls, you know, singing to everybody like that. He's that. So I think he understood this guy, like feed him.
Yeah. How can I? Yeah. I'm expressing my knowledge and history through him. Okay, so let's talk about Voodoo, because you were talking about first album and you're talking about it as it sounds like sketches, which is, I think, totally fair. I know this is like a bit of a stretch, but what it reminds me of sonically in moments is the first Wu-Tang album, where it's like not totally fully formed. Like it's like you hear the roughness around the edges. And obviously the roughness on the D'Angelo record is not the same as the roughness on the Wu-Tang record, but there is this kind of like, it's not, the seam's not finished, as it were. You know, it's not fully stitched. Voodoo is a very stitched album, obviously, by comparison, but it is quixotic and has a lot of bleed in a number of other kinds of directions. And I feel like tonally, such an incredibly consistent mood, but also sometimes I feel like there's mood and the words get lost inside the mood, or the words are subservient to the mood in places. I wonder what you think of how voodoo functions as a full piece, less individual songs, because obviously Untitled is its own thing. But like as a full piece, how do you experience this album, and what do you think is the innovation of voodoo compared to the first album?
This is the album that establishes this is one of the greatest musicians, maybe the greatest musician of his generation, of the post-Prince era. You don't necessarily have to love every song, although I remember, I felt like all of us were just listening to the whole album all the time for a while.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of one of those albums, it's like, this could just be one track. Like, you know, it's like this could just press play at minute one, and then you're at minute 40, and it's fine.
I mean, you think about Hear My Dear, and There's a Riot Going On, Marvin Gaye, Sly Stone, as like these sort of predecessors to this, is like, it's real, it's honest, it's intimate, it's more than we sat down to make 12 songs that you might like. It's like, this just poured out of us, and, you know, here it is.
And also, we created a world. Like, it's like we created a thing designed to envelop. It envelops us as musician and performer. It's in many places, again, it's an atmosphere even more than it is song structure, which is totally fine and great. And it's also, we're aiming to envelop you. It is genuinely designed to be taken in a full way, not in a kind of like dip in and out way.
Yeah, I remember loving Devil's Pie and Chicken Grease. But the real music heads, like the practitioners, were like, Africa. That's the fucking one that really slays us. You know, I mean, there's just so much on this album. I mean, like, you know, Raphael Sadiq is part of making this, Roy Hargrove, Charlie Hunter, James Poyser, obviously Angie Stone, who's a great part of D'Angelo's whole era,
the
whole conversation. He loved her, and they're, you know, children together, but like an amazing sort of musical collaborator for him, and she's an amazing singer in her own right. But yeah, I mean, it was just this towering soul funk conversation that was just like, you went to your parents' house and you're like, oh, all the times that I saw the Curtis Mayfield and Al Green albums, I just never saw this one. And I just skipped over it. And like, this is also just as good as all that stuff. You know, you could practically take it to your parents and be like, see, my generation ain't fucking around. We make great music too.
Okay, you mentioned something a few minutes ago about kind of like, could Neo Soul hold? Like, how, why didn't it last 25 years or whatnot? And some of it, as I think about this perfectionism that we're talking about, of like, I've got to take this time to really make this right. The treats, as you say, I've got to absorb the treats so that I can go out and make my own treat. So I think in part, it's because of that. It's because this is a labor process that takes its time. It has to gestate. It has to simmer. But I also think, and I don't think this is about a lot of albums, generally speaking, but voodoo is almost impossible to replicate. It is literally not a thing that you can, as another musician, listen to and be like, I can make my version of this, because it requires such a level of mastery, deftness, liveness, spirituality, engagement. It's not a form that me and you could go into a studio the day after and be like, we can kind of do it. Like, we can kind of do it. And I think when you make a singular work in a small genre or subgenre, sometimes people really try to replicate and extend it, but at that time, I think it stood out so clearly that maybe people got scared off and said, I actually don't want it. Like, let it be. We're going to go another direction.
Here's the thing I think about is that the music industry is not really conducive to creativity. It does not really nurture or want true creativity. Part of the marketing of this album led to the downfall of D'Angelo, that, you know, his manager Dominic Trenier, who's also a friend of mine, who's passed away a long time ago, envisioned, oh, we're going to do this video for Untitled, where you are naked and we're going to see your body up close. And this is a big thing within him, that he was a fat kid, right? And on Brown Sugar, he was overweight, I guess, for a regular person, and definitely overweight for a recording artist. Mm-hmm. And part of what was going on in those 5 years between Brown Sugar and Voodoo was obsessively working out all the time and getting the weight down and getting the body to be in unbelievable shape. And they were just doing all kinds of work and thoughtful about the way he ate. And by the time it came time to do Untitled, the body looked incredible. The video made people say, oh, he's a sex symbol, which he already was. But after that, you go to concerts and people would say, take your shirt off. And he's like, he's having all kind of issues because he's like, I want you to listen to the music and not just say, take your shirt off. And I also want you to pay attention to me. But you know the body dysmorphia thing where you see something different in the mirror than what is actually exists? He's going through that because he's seen himself in his mind all his life as overweight. So he's going through all this stuff. And it really made him want to push away from all of this. So the marketing of the album makes it harder for him to continue on the musical creative path that he's on. So that experience is a large part of why he doesn't come back for 14 years. He purposely destroys his body, you know, with food and not working out. See the pictures of him like 3, 4, 5 years later. He's gone back to being really big. He's rebelling against what was needed to promote the album, right? So the marketing is running counter to the creativity. Right. And it's blocking the creativity. He's trying to show you what a brilliant musician he is and all these amazing chord changes they came up with. And they're screaming, take your shirt off. And yes, this is what women and female artists specifically deal with constantly, noted. But this is what D'Angelo is explaining to me. And the women are going, we deal with that all the time. Stipulated. I understand that. And, you know, it was a big sort of psychological struggle for him to deal with that.
Sorry, man, I appreciate you coming and talking about this era. You know, I find, especially with a lot of the younger folks that I'm talking to, they only experience the D'Angelo later period. They don't know what it was like in that moment from the 95 on to 99 and 2000 and how all of that was earned. It did not just arrive in magic. That was work.
He's a superstar. You know, I mean, this is a prodigy who, you know, just made one of the great albums of his generation and lived up to the promise of what D'Angelo could become with Voodoo. You know, it's just, it's a shame. And it's unbelievable that it's like within 12 months, he and Angie go together.
I know.
It's unbelievable.
Thank you, Torre. Appreciate that. We're going to go out with something from Voodoo. Let's listen to Feel Like Making Love, and then we'll be back with Joseph Patel after this.
Hi, I'm Juliet.
I'm Joel. We're from the New York Times games team.
And we're here talking to fans about our games.
What's your vibe when you're playing one of our games?
It makes me feel like I'm procrastinating in a really productive way.
It just scratches an itch in my brain. Do you have a routine?
I'm doing long distance with my boyfriend. We'll call every night and share our screen. We do the connections, the mini, and then strands. Always in that order.
Aww. Do you have a favorite?
The mini. We try and get it under 30 seconds. We rarely get it under 30, but that's always the goal.
Folks will really time themselves, but with Spelling Bee, I give myself all day.
I play it when my kids are going to bed.
Do you guys play together?
My daughter plays. She likes playing Wordle.
If you ever miss a day, there's also archives.
That's so great to know.
And you have it for connections as well.
Lord help me. I'm just going to be doing that all day, every day.
New York Times Games subscribers get full access to all our games and features. Subscribe now at nytimes.com/games for a special offer.
We're back. It's part two of the D'Angelo Popcast. We're here with Joseph Patel. welcome. Happy to see you.
Likewise. I every time someone dies, I'm here.
I hate that for us collectively, but also this is an opportunity for us to share a few of the gems. You know, age matters, history matters, memories matter. You know Joseph from producing Summer of Soul and Sly Lives. He's working on a documentary about J. Dilla now. I actually want to start with recent stuff and then go backwards. In the Sly documentary, you guys, you and Questlove, are able to sit with D'Angelo. There is not a lot of recent footage of D'Angelo, certainly from the last few years. I know just from talking to you outside of this context how meaningful and intense that conversation was. I wonder if you can share a little bit about both the talk itself, but also, obviously, I know it was no easy feat getting to that. If you could talk about why it was important to have him in that film specifically.
Yeah, you know, I think when we talked about the Sly Stone story, we talked about other artists who went through the same thing as Sly.
Yeah.
And D'Angelo as an avatar for Sly is pretty spot on, right? I think even D'Angelo would admit that. And, you know, part of our narrative for the Sly documentary was to show how a lot of the contours of Sly's own story had reverberated through time with other Black musicians. And D'Angelo was someone we wanted from the beginning. You know, Amir has a relationship with D'Angelo that spans back almost 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it was not an easy interview to get for a lot of reasons. One of which is most is D'Angelo just doesn't do a lot. And two is that I look back on it now, and I don't think I'm talking out of school when I say this, is that he was going through some health issues at the time. And so it took about a year from our first request to the actual interview day to really nail it down. And the only reason he did that interview is because of his relationship with Amir.
Sure.
And, you know, we came in wanting to talk to him about Sly, but the larger theme of the film was about Black genius and this burden that is put on Black artists when they have success, something Amir has gone through himself, but something I think D'Angelo more publicly and more famously has gone through in the 25, 30 years that he's been in the public eye. And so I think from a narrative standpoint, it was important to have him in the film. And then, you know, if you've seen the film, he's talking about Sly, but really he's talking about himself.
As a Black artist, how hard is it to be vulnerable in front of a world watching you?
It's really hard. It's the hardest thing to do. The hang-ups, baggage, guilt, and the pain and the shame that comes with it, you know? And if you don't know how to handle it, if you don't have your soul centered and people around you that you really trust and people that really know you and it's really down for you. Yeah, man, it can be unbearable, man. Yeah. It'll turn you into an unwilling participant. And that's equivalent to hell.
There are also moments with Dee, but also with others in the film, where Questlove, because you hear Questlove talking, is explicitly asking people to draw that line to their own lives. Like, it's like, I don't know what got you in the chair in the first place, but he's explicitly being like, yeah, you're here for two reasons. Even you're here for two reasons.
Yeah. Once we got him in the chair, it's like, what are they going to do? Get up and leave. It's not quite that. But, you know, I think when you have a rapport with the subject, you take it where you can take it. Mm-hmm. And I think D was a really good sport. He looked amazing. He was in good spirits. He came with his girlfriend and a couple of people on his team, stylists, because I think how he looked was really important to him because, you know, he knows a documentary is forever, you know, and that was a concern, right? I think for a lot of a lot of people who are in films, I think that's an increasing concern. And he was 8 hours late and we had a hard out at Electric Lady. Shout out to Lee over there who was very patient with us that night and always is always very accommodating for us. You know, he gave us everything we hoped and more in that interview. And in hindsight, it was the last interview he did, which is part of a lot that's been hard to deal with this week.
Yeah. One of the things that, to the extent that this has been tough to grapple with, obviously the age is it's a heavy weight to think of someone this young who had achieved the things that he achieved. But also, and you and I spoke a couple of days ago, and I think we sort of had opposite views on the same thing, which is I was like, we didn't get enough. And you were kind of like, what a blessing that we got as much as we did, right? When you go back and look, there are not loads of interviews. I mean, there's only three albums. There's obviously unreleased stuff and bootlegs and live bootlegs and stuff floating around, but there's only three albums. There's not loads of press after the Voodoo era, which is 2000. There's bits and pieces. There's some stuff around Black Messiah. There's your film. There's a few things. There's the documentary that circulates online, but it's just not formal and was never officially released. There's just not loads of stuff. And I wonder, when you think about how an artist presents to the world, chooses to present to the world, and when they choose to present to the world largely through reluctance or distance, what is that meant to tell us in terms of how we should talk about the art itself?
Oh, man. You know, it's weird because, like, D'Angelo is one of those artists that if he just hopped on a hotel piano and riffed for 15 minutes, it'd probably be the greatest thing you've ever heard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He was just one of those ones who anything they did was interesting and you felt the full force of their being and who they were and even where they come from and their ancestors and all of that. Like, every single time you hear a D'Angelo song on record or live, you're not being shortchanged at all. And it's like every ounce of his being is channeling that music to you. And it's like that on every song, right? And I think that's part of what's made this really hard to deal with this week, is that knowing that we will never get that again. But he's also one of those people that I think, you know, we in the public want so much of artists that mean something to us, which is a natural human, I think, inclination. But one of the things I discovered in my career, having interviewed D'Angelo a couple of times and having met him a handful more, is the best thing in the world, second to hearing him play music, is probably talking music with him.
Yeah, sure.
And I think the friends and the people in his life, his collaborators, and the friends and family in his life got a lot of that from him. We, the public, don't.
Right.
And I think we just want more of that, right? And I forget your original question, those are the two things I wanted to say.
That's what it brought up. In the film, like the film, we see bits and pieces of D'Angelo. I know you talked to him, obviously, for longer than you used. I wonder if you could talk about some of the things in that conversation that remain with you, even if they didn't end up making it into Final Cut.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what he talked about made it into the film. I mean, he went deep on a lot of these things that we just excerpted a little bit. You know, there's a thing he says at the end of the film, which is actually really, it was funny when he said it, which was like, he was talking about the legacies of Black artists versus white artists. And he says a lot of white artists, and he's talking about white legacy artists, you know, it's like they get to die in their tomato garden playing with their grandkids, like in The Godfather. The other half of that bite, which we didn't use in the film, is him saying, and meanwhile, Black artists of that age are on stage at Essence Fest in August, shaking their ass in 100-degree heat. And a few months after that interview, Angie Stone passes away in a car accident on touring the South.
Yeah.
And that's all I could think about when I heard that news, is that here's his ex and his baby's mother. Who died in a car accident while touring, because that's how she had to make money.
Right. She didn't have a nest egg from her earlier years. And that's a person who was making music and releasing music as far back as like 1980 or 81, you know.
And had hits.
Yeah.
And famously had problems with her label. And I think the resonance of everything D'Angelo told us in that interview that is in the film and around it was spoken out of real world observation and experience. And I think that's what made the interview with him for the film so useful for storytelling, but also just so real and resonant as a viewer.
as we've said, not many people got to speak to D'Angelo in the press, just generally speaking. You're probably one of the only people who spoke to him multiple times, and you spoke to him in different generations, in different eras of his life. You wrote the paper magazine cover story from 2000, Voodoo Era. And that cover, you know, we could talk about Untitled and kind of how that reframed D'Angelo's public narrative. That cover certainly was very much leaning into that version of his public self. But I wonder if you could talk about the difference, if there was any, between talking to him in 2000 and talking to him in 2024.
Yeah, that paper magazine cover was actually in 1999.
My bad.
At the end of 99. I talked to him in October of 1999. I had just moved to New York 6 months earlier. It was my first cover story for paper magazine. It was the first Voodoo cover story, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
I think the press plan was, let's do a cool magazine first, and then we'll do the big magazines. And because it was the first feature around Voodoo, I got a copy of the album in September of 99, still unfinished. There's a song on that advanced CD that has never come out that I still have, which is a cover of Water Got No Enemy that was supposed to be a duet between D'Angelo and Lauryn Hill. And on the song, you can hear D'Angelo, it's a reference track, and you can hear him say, Lauren, this is where you come in. And then he sings her part in falsetto. Mm. I've never seen that surface on the internet or on YouTube or anywhere since then. I've been sitting on this song for 26 years, right? I got to go to the studio at Electric Lady while they were finishing the album.
Yeah.
I got to go to the music video shoot for Left and Right, which was at some brothel down by the South Street Seaport. I think it's the old Def Jux office. And they had turned this building into a brothel for 3 days and basically had shot the video at intermittent hours throughout the 3 days. I don't need to tell you that you know how, but babe, you do. Oh, I said you belong. And if you dream to be free. I'd never seen an artist execute at that level before. And obviously I had some insight into the recording process through my friendship with Questlove. I think that D'Angelo did not know what was to come in terms of the intensity of scrutiny from the public, because once Voodoo came out, and specifically once Untitled came out, everything changed for him.
Yeah.
He truly would have been happiest just playing music with no eyeballs on him. And then the exact opposite happened, where it wasn't just that he was popular, it was that he did a video that was so locked in on how he looked.
Yeah.
And he was forced to sort of like have to sort of be that person every night on tour. And I think that really fucked him up for a while, like it would fuck anybody up.
Yeah.
And the D'Angelo that spoke to us in the Sly documentary late last year is one who came out the other side of that alive. And I think that was the thing I appreciated the most. I will say this, and I don't think this is inappropriate to say, but you know, that night that we were interviewing D'Angelo for the Sly film, he was supposed to come at 6 p.m. and he didn't arrive till 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. or sorry, 1 a.m. And we waited it out. And basically what I told the crew, even before we booked them for the shoot and everybody who's going to be on set, I said, look, we're going to wait this out till however long it takes. Mm-hmm. I need to know you can hang, because the opportunity to get him is so rare. And I don't want to miss this opportunity, because we don't know when we'll ever get that opportunity again.
Yeah.
And the day, a couple of days ago, when the news of his passing happened, the DP of the shoot that day texted me. He's like, I'm so glad we waited for D'Angelo that night.
Yeah.
And I know why he was texting that, but I think he also meant that it was worth it to hear him speak to Amir, not a journalist, but to Amir.
Yeah.
And to say these things that maybe he wouldn't tell a normal journalist.
Yeah.
And it was a real thrill for me to be able to witness these two musicians who I admire and respect beyond the world, to be in conversation with each other. It was just the three of us and our sound mixer in the room at Electric Lady, where so much magic had happened. Like, it's just like one of those experiences I'll take with me forever.
Can you talk a little bit about Brown Sugar, Voodoo, Black Messiah? To me, are three almost like blank canvas albums. It's not that they're not in conversation with each other. It's not that it's not the same guy making them, but it's like there are core principles of each of those albums that I think are different, even if they're made by the same person with the same gifts. And I wonder, through your lens, if you could talk about how each of those individual albums functions, and also, you know, function in relation to where the world was when they came out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about that the last few days, right? I've had all three albums on repeat. He makes Brown Sugar with Ali Shaheed Muhammad. Mm-hmm. It's in the mid-90s, right? Early to mid-90s, when everything seems so gilded, mm-hmm. right? And black music is exploding and R&B music is exploding specifically. And, you know, for much of the late 80s, early part of the 90s, there was a real divide between hip-hop and R&B, right? And that melted away at the top of the 90s. Yep. And here comes D'Angelo. He's not singing over hip-hop beats. He's doing something else. Mm-hmm. He's not putting two things together and presenting it as a third thing. He's literally synthesizing the source material for both into one new thing.
Yeah, it doesn't call attention to itself. It's almost, I mean, and it seems crazy to say this 30 years later when it's all so obvious, but in the moment, it was just like, if you had been listening to both R&B and rap music from 1988 to 1994, you played that album and you instinctually understood what he had done.
Yeah.
And nobody else had done to that point. You heard it and you said, ah, he figured something out.
He figured something out and he unlocked a new door, right?
Yeah.
And it felt so organic and natural and not at all, you know, manufactured or manicured. And I think that album, you know, Ali Shaheed Muhammad was his sort of like OG on that record, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have Voodoo, which he starts recording just a year or two later, right? Like the Brown Sugar comes out, what, 95, I think?
Brown Sugar's 95, Voodoo's 2000.
Voodoo's 2000, but I think they started recording Voodoo. I think he started writing songs for Voodoo like late 96. And I think when he meets Questlove in 1996, he meets a kindred spirit. And then he meets Dilla. They're both sort of obsessed with Dilla. Mm-hmm. And it just sends them in this other direction. And Voodoo is so interesting because he is clearly channeling ghosts. D'Angelo is a person who lived with ghosts. And not in a negative way, necessarily, right? And I think that album sounds like old and new at the same time.
Yeah.
And again, in such an organic way and in a thorough way. I mean, it took him, I think, a few years to really hone in on that sound and what that spirit. But you listen to Voodoo and there's nothing else like it. Not before, not after.
Yeah.
And then you go to Black Messiah and it's the same thing. His muse for that record, his collaborating muse, is Q-Tip. It's not Questlove anymore. It's Q-Tip. And Q-Tip helps him write a lot of the verses that he sings on that album. And it has a definitely harder rock feel. But then if you listen to all three albums together in sequence, as distinct as they are, and they have to be distinct because they're made like 10 years apart, yep. right? Like mm-hmm. 5 to 10 years apart. But when you listen to all three in sequence, they actually are connected in a weird way. The ideas on Brown Sugar sort of hand off to some of the ideas on Voodoo that then take it to a different place that hand off to some of the ideas on Black Messiah. And I think, you know, when you and I were talking a couple of days ago, it's like D'Angelo, the fact that we got any music from him at all is a miracle. The fact that we got three albums that are flawless is a miracle. And something about those three records are connected. And I don't know what that means other than, you know, he's the connection. He's the one that gives it to us. If he had done a fourth album, it would have been connected somehow.
Yeah. When I think about those records, what's striking to me about them is they have so much to say to their specific historical moment without feeling like they have been made in their historical moment.
Yeah.
Like the inevitability of Brown Sugar is the lesson. It's not a middle finger. There's a lot of people who want to say, I made a record about what's happening right now and it's different. And I want you to know, like, I'm like, look at what I did. That's not what that album does. That album, it could have come out in 89 or 97 or whatever. Like it's unmistakably important to that moment. Voodoo, same thing. You know, you're at the tail end of the glamour of the 90s, and what Quest and D are doing is actually saying, great, we just made like a 1973 record or a 1978 record. Like, we know all that happened. Like, we're fans. We're into it. We know it all happened. And we just locked in to, again, not reject, but to be on a parallel path somewhere. And then Black Messiah is like an absorption of public life into the sonic art. It's an implicit conversation with what's happening in the world, more so than the first two albums.
Yeah, and I think the word inevitable is exactly right. Each of those albums feels inevitable. And what's remarkable is that they were in the process of being made long before the moments they came out into the world that made it feel inevitable.
Yeah.
Which tells you something about what he's channeling.
Right.
And what those musicians are channeling. The thing that's most impressive to me about Voodoo is Voodoo is a D'Angelo album. It's him channeling the spirits, but it's every other person involved locked in sync with that vision and what D'Angelo is trying to say and making it happen. It's Questlove's drumming. It's not a retro album because the way Amir is drumming is futuristic.
Yeah.
The way Pino is playing is futuristic.
Yeah.
The way Charlie Hunter is playing guitar and bass at the same time is a different mode of thinking. The way Russ Elovato engineers that album, right? The way Untitled cuts off at the end because the tape runs out and they leave it. That's a decision. That's a choice. The early version of Voodoo I Have starts with Jimi Hendrix, a Jimi Hendrix voice before Playa Playa. And it's funny because that would have made the album feel like a very obvious harken back to a time.
Yeah.
And they take it out and it works better with it out, right? Because when you put on that record, it feels like ghosts are entering the room.
But that's such a wild way to describe it as future, like the playing is futuristic, because I wouldn't necessarily think of it that way. But I think if you're stripping down to the component parts, the component tracks, that probably is very, like, I've never listened to it that way, but that probably is incredibly right that Quest was doing stuff that he had not done in other places and maybe couldn't do with other artists.
And wasn't trained to do, right? This is the thing. Dan Charnas writes about this in Dilla Time, which obviously is the basis of the Dilla documentary we're doing. And Dan makes these observations culled from these interviews with musicians, but also his own observations that, you know, the way Amir is playing behind, the way Amir plays is inspired by Dilla. And because D'Angelo and Amir were both sort of obsessed and coalescing around this Dilla rhythm, Amir has to unlearn a lifetime of drumming in order to play the way D'Angelo and him are hearing the song. And breaking that convention is what's futuristic about it. Pino has to play behind or ahead of the drumming. And D'Angelo is the one sort of orchestrating all of this. No, it doesn't sound right like this. It has to sound like this. And he's asking these musicians to do things a lifetime of education says don't do. It's wrong. Yeah. For anybody listening who hasn't read Dilla Time, I would highly suggest reading Dilla Time. Mm-hmm. The writing Dan Charnas does about Dilla and D'Angelo specifically is very, very educational and, you know, enthralling. But it takes an executive at Virgin Records to say, okay, this is the album we're going to put out, even though there's no, every song is 7 minutes long. And what, you know, what is this album? Even with Black Messiah, D'Angelo had been working on that album for like 5 or 6 years. Like, I think he started going back in the studio in 2007, 8, 9 to work on some of those songs. I remember going to Electric Lady in 2009 and he was working. I have 3 songs from those sessions that 2 of them end up on Black Messiah, Really Love and Back. And I don't know if you remember, but Black Messiah came out suddenly.
Yeah.
Right? At the end of the year.
Yeah.
It was like
in December, mid-December or something.
Yeah. And it was just like, it wasn't on anyone's radar. And then suddenly there was like, you know, I think the end of 2014, it was like, oh, this album's coming out next week. And some people ascribe that to D'Angelo's feelings around Ferguson and what was happening in the country at the time. And it is the perfect soundtrack for what was happening, not only in music at the time, but in the country. But those were ideas that were being formed 4, 5, 6 years earlier. So he was channeling something that he knew was ahead of him.
Yeah, and even with some, you know, what was happening in the news, it's like, that's been happening forever. Ferguson is simply the, and it's not the end point of any, but it's certainly like a way station on a thing that's been happening for decades and centuries. But the idea that D'Angelo had the perfect album for that moment simmering for 5 years prior to that moment, it is interesting to think of him as a futuristic artist. I truly hadn't engaged with it that way, but I wonder what it must have been like to know that there will be a moment in the future that needs this thing that maybe only I, D'Angelo, am able to do and probably have to do to feel musically whole, creatively whole.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that what that means, I think D'Angelo felt things, right?
Yeah.
He was channeling spirits and ghosts and experience, but he also firmly felt what was rumbling on the ground.
Yeah.
Whether he was conscious of it or not, this is how it played out for him. And I think the thing that is most debilitating about the news of his passing this week is that, like you said, there's a moment that will require someone to articulate what's happening and how we see and feel things that he could have done and probably would have done that won't be there. And it will be now left to somebody else to do that in their own way. But I don't know how many artists like that we have.
You mentioned it's 5 years between album one, album two. It's 14 years between album two and album three. And the value of gestation and addition and subtraction and addition and painting over your old painting until you get to the right painting. You know, that's not a contemporary value.
That's not a contemporary value.
And it's also not, I think, even understood. Forget whether anybody's doing it. I also don't think it's understood. As a middle-aged person, I sometimes feel blessed to understand how it once was and also how it currently is. I do think it is worth, obviously, to listen to these albums, but also to understand that if you started today, imagine where you will be in your life 2 to 3 years from now, and imagine you worked on one thing from now until that point, obviously with some breaks, but imagine what you might achieve with your own talent, your gift, whatever that might be, if you are in constant dialogue and reinvention with yourself to grow yourself.
And I think the thing is, and I keep coming back to this, D'Angelo was a channeler, right? And I think I would have told you this had he not passed this week.
Yeah.
The more I've listened to him lately, the more I understood him to be a channeler, because that night when we interviewed him at Electric Lady for the Sly Doc, he came at his own time. His sense of time did not sync up with our sense of time.
Yeah.
Oh, 6 p.m., that's an abstraction.
Sure.
Right? You need me tonight, so I'll show up tonight. Mm-hmm. I don't know what time, but that's tonight.
I'll be there.
Right? But he'll be there.
Yeah.
The album Black Messiah will come out. I don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
When it feels right.
Yeah.
Whether that's 5 years, whether that's 14 years. One of my favorite things in the D'Angelo story as us as music fans is, I believe it's 2013, right? March of 2013. Him and Amir, D'Angelo and Questlove, play the Brooklyn Bowl. And it's just the two of them. And they're just jamming. Just two friends jamming. Find the video on YouTube. I think some people have uploaded the full set. And if you were there that night, it was magic. And for me, Questlove and D'Angelo, when they first met in 1996, they jammed, just the two of them. And I remember the first time I met Amir, I was interviewing them for Rap Pages magazine in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And after the interview, we were just hanging out and just talking about music. He played me about an hour and a half of this jam session. And a couple of the songs have leaked from those sessions, like D'Angelo has a cover of Everybody Loves the Sunshine, where it's just him on falsetto vocals and keyboard and Amir on drums. They do a couple of Gangstar covers, instrumental covers. And it's like, there's a purity to that relationship between D'Angelo and Questlove that gets exercised during Voodoo. It goes away for a few years for whatever reason. And then around 2013, it comes back together again. And on stage at Brooklyn Bowl, and I think they did another night in Philly a few nights later, they just jam. And it's two brothers, two musical brothers, locked in, and they do covers of Sly and the Family Stone, of Funkadelic, Tell Me If You Still Care from the SOS Band. They do a couple of D'Angelo songs from the Voodoo era. They do a Prince cover, obviously, because both of those, you know, musicians, those people are locked in on Prince, Sons of Prince. And it's just one of the most pure, joyful, important pieces of music I've ever witnessed in my life.
You mentioned the show. I was also at this show. I just was like, let me look through my phone to see. Unfortunately, I do not think that I have any video from that night, although apparently on YouTube, as you say. I do have a picture of the set list. via Elliot Wilson's Instagram. I do have a picture of me and Jean Grey.
Shout out Jean Grey.
Shout out Jean Grey. I do have a picture of the soundboard. I do have a picture of a bunch of people's Jordans, including mine. And I do have a picture of me, you, Neil Drumming, and Peter Orlov.
I have that. I do have that photo. Yeah.
Yeah. That was an incredible night. Yeah. Anyway, just even in a week of mourning, it's I am also grateful as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I really feel for my guy, Questlove.
Yeah.
You know, I think what it must be like to be a musician who, even amongst your peers, is you're a great musician, and then to find a sort of spiritual kin, and then to lose that kin.
Yeah.
I just think D'Angelo's passing is a huge loss, obviously for his family and his friends, but, you know, there are certain people that come from the universe and are here, and we get to experience it, and we get to absorb it, and we get to live with it, and it moves us, it changes us, it shapes us. And to know that that's gone is really been hard, I think, this week for a lot of people.
Yeah, and as we were saying earlier, I think it's quite striking to know that this is a person who answered questions that perhaps even we didn't think to ask until we had the answer in front of us. Is there a particular song you want to hear on the out?
Oh, that's a good question.
Mm.
Let me pick a song.
Yeah, please.
Actually, can we talk about something real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to know a very slept on D'Angelo song?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Ronson did an album.
Oh, yeah.
And they did a song collaboration called Glass Mountain Trust.
Yeah.
That song, it is such a jam.
Yeah, we should listen to that song.
Oh, it's so good. It's D'Angelo as a rock funk, like, vocalist, and just like there's such propulsive energy to that song. It's a great song.
Also, I saw, I think maybe Mark, maybe on Instagram, posted after D passed talking about that song and how he had given D'Angelo the instrumental and sort of said, hey, here's a pocket that I think maybe if you want to do something. And, you know, obviously D'Angelo took a very long time and got it back to him like right last minute. And I think what D'Angelo said to him per Mark is, I'm sorry, I was late. I spent all this time trying to figure out what Glass Mountain Trust meant.
don't go out on that song though. That's not the right song.
It's a good song though.
It's a good song though. But that's funny. And I saw Mark's post because he posted a picture of Dominique.
Yeah.
Trenier.
Rest in peace. Yeah.
Who was someone I also got to know and I can't believe is also gone. Yeah. And I hope they're somewhere having fun and causing trouble together. But the song I think to go out on is Africa. I think that's the one.
That's the one. Okay, we'll do that. That's our show. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. That's New Podcast, which is also on video at youtube.com/podcast. Me and Joe interviewing some of your favorite stars and chatting over big issues. It's old podcast like this. Every kind of podcast at nytimes.com/podcast. Like I said, get us on YouTube, also on TikTok and Instagram at podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with any questions for future mailbags, with thoughts on D'Angelo. Also, we're going to do a bet settling episode at some point. If you have some bets that you need settled, go ahead and drop us a line, podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook, get in the Discord, getting the t-shirt and mugs. All the links are on the bottom of every YouTube video, so go ahead and check those out. Grab a t-shirt, grab a mug for the holidays. Our producer is Nick Pittman. We will be back next week. This is Africa.